Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Jan Doolittle Wilson is back to talk about Dany and, of course, one of our favorite topics, Miri Mazdour. If you're looking for Steve and I covering Season 8 of Game of Thrones, we are over at Double Dragon. Search for that wherever you search for podcasts. We are also using that feed to cover House of the Dragon, episode by episode. Okay, without further ado, here is Dr. Jan Doolittle Wilson. Well, Jan, I think that this next chapter, Dany 9, I think that this chapter is maybe on the short list for the climax of the book. You know, we talked about the climax of the book before. It's odd how much Martin likes to leave off page, right?
Yes.
But the story has certainly turned. Dany is kind of goes into full dragon mode this chapter. If this is not the climax of the book, it's absolutely in the conversation for one of maybe two or three chapters that could be called the climax.
I mean, it's definitely the beginning of the birth of a new Dany, right?
Right.
And, you know, certainly the last chapter is where she fully emerges, but this is the beginning of that and something very distinct. She's pulling away from one thing and something else is being born. And I think, you know, of course, part of that, we talked about this before, with so many of the female characters in Game of Thrones, the men around them have to die for them to really come into their own, sure. Right? Because this is a patriarchal world and, you know, women aren't assumed to be leaders, right? They have power only indirectly through the men in their lives. And, you know, Dany has gone through this entire book now where the powerful men around her have pretty much fallen off. And this is the last of it, right?
Do you think that's something of a little bit deceptive? I mean, I think that 99 times out of 100, if the male dies, then that's bad for the woman, all of the women in his life. In the ancient world, you know, it's like, you know, what's going to happen to the wife of the king? If the king dies, then that person's probably, maybe that person's killed. Maybe that person goes into obscurity. Martin really likes to use that guy as a husk.
Yeah.
And so the woman can kind of emerge in a way that's very cathartic, you know?
Yes. Yes. I mean, you could name a variety of characters that happens to, right? Mm-hmm. And so this isn't normally how it happens in history. You're right.
I mean, you do have characters like Penny, who's like, her man dies. So much the worse for her, you know?
Right.
So... anyway, I just wanted to point that out that, you know, it's easy to look at the stories of all of the powerful women in Martin's world and maybe get an odd perspective on what actually the consequences are.
Right.
When someone like Khal Drogo dies.
Right. And typically this is not supposed to happen, right? What was her destiny as the Khaleesi?
Yeah.
Her destiny was to be taken to the crones, right? To live out the rest of her life surrounded by these other older women, right? Because once her husband dies, her job is done, right? Her purpose is gone.
Something that she's kind of been putting off.
right. And, you know, even the blood riders at the end say to her, we'll stay until after the funeral. And then once the funeral's over, we'll escort you, you know, to this place. And that's your fate. And that's what's waiting for her. That's what is supposed to happen.
The other thing that I wanted to note here is that, you know, we're talking about the death of the male, but oftentimes, you know, if maternal mortality has a parallel to the ancient world, it's one every eight.
Yes.
One of every eight pregnancies results in the death of the mother.
Yes.
Pregnancy in many ways is looking down the barrel of a possible death.
Right.
More often than not, it's going to result in, you know, in a new life. But it happens enough that you should be thinking about the possibility of death, right?
Yeah, and there's another strange inversion here, right? It's not only that, okay, the call dies, and instead of, you know, Khaleesi just kind of fading away, you know, with the other old women, she becomes this brand new person, like, you know, the phoenix rising from the ashes. Mm-hmm. And the other inversion here is what you just said, right? The idea that her son is sacrificed and she emerges, when in fact, with a male child in her womb, it should be the opposite in the society. Right. Where she is basically the vessel. Right. She gives birth to the son and then she dies. And so everything is kind of inverted in really interesting ways.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and read my synopsis and we jump right in.
OK.
Dany's dreams are overshadowed with the thought of dragons. The repeated refrain is, "You don't want to wake the dragon, do you?" She feels ice and darkness and death behind her as she tries to make it to the red door. She dreams of sex with Drogo. She dreams of Viserys' death. She dreams of her grown son and her brother Rhaegar. When she wakes, she feels immense pain and crawls for her dragon eggs. She sleeps and wakes again, wanting to hold her dragon eggs. Then, when finally conscious, she asks about Jorah and Drogo and her son. She learns that her son is dead. According to Miri, the child was monstrous and had been dead for years. She demands to see Drogo. He's alive, but lifeless. The God's Wife explains that Dany knew the price, that Drogo's men were murderers and rapists, and that the stallion who mans the world will make no one suffer. Dany has Miri removed and tries to wake Drogo from his stupor. When nothing works, she smothers his face with a pillow. Oh my gosh.
Oh my goodness. That's a lot.
Oh goodness. There's so much that happens in this chapter. And so much.
So much.
The first few pages are just Dany's dream, where you kind of see in this ethereal tone her transforming into a dragon, right?
Yeah.
So we were talking.
Remind you of
some
of Bran's dreams earlier?
A little bit.
I kept thinking of Bran when I read this.
It's funny that you say that because I was wondering as I was reading this, I was like, okay, I know this is a fantasy narrative, but how often have we actually seen magic in this first book?
Yes.
We saw it in the prologue because, you know, they have their magical monsters, right?
Right.
Bran's dreams we know in retrospect are magic, but it's very subtle.
Yes.
And then you get to this chapter and it's like magic is on full display. We knew that there were images of dead people or big wolves or a fiery man walking around with Miri Mazdoor dancing around.
Right.
And then we hear tell of Dany's dragonish baby. And it's very clear in this chapter that this is a story about magic.
Right.
But we're pretty much we're getting right to the end of the book, right? So,
and then it bursts forth, right?
You're right. Everything about sort of all of the stuff about Bran's dreams is sort of flooding back. And I maybe because of this, you're starting to rethink, maybe Bran's dreams were magic.
You're right. We just get these, this is again what makes these books so masterful in so many ways because you get to the end and think, oh, the signs were there. They were there, but it was introduced so gradually. I love that. And then you start learning right in the next couple of books about, you know, warging and the different powers and, of course, tons of dragon lore.
And
yeah, it's great.
Against this backdrop, Jorah in this chapter kind of functions as the skeptic.
Yes.
I think for a lot of, in Bran's
chapter, but he has doubt in his eyes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. In Bran's chapter, Maester Luwin is sort of functions as the skeptic. He's like, yeah, dreams are dreams.
Right.
In this chapter,
old Nan is crazy.
Yeah, that's right. These are just old ladies' tales. But in this chapter, Jorah feels the egg and it just feels cold to him, whereas Dany can feel the heat.
Very significant.
And then also, even though Jorah won't say it aloud, Dany suspects that Jorah has seen something he can't explain. And what Joris says is, look, I just saw shadows. That's all I saw, shadows.
Right.
But Danny gets the sense like, no, you probably saw what I saw, because I'm pretty sure I saw something more than shadows.
Right. I think you should do a whole podcast on different forms of magic in Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's
that would be so much fun, wouldn't it?
Oh, there's so much.
There's so much. And, you know, what forms are considered acceptable within certain cultures and which forms are forbidden. How is that different, you know, in terms of Westeros versus Essos and different places in Essos? Yeah. And I think that would be, we could talk about Melisandre. And see, I'm saying we, assuming that I would be a part of this.
Oh my gosh. It would be so great to talk about the different, I mean, based on this first book, you're not really certain how much magic is in this. Like, like the Weirwood trees could just be trees, right? I mean, there's nothing, but they're right there. It's right. They're really important. And, you know, people like Asha tell us that, you know, that the gods are listening. And I mean, there's tons of stuff baked in, but it's subtle and disguised enough in this first book that when you meet someone like Mel in the next book, it's kind of shocking. You know, it's a little bit, whoa, what kind of story are we dealing with here? Because there's a major shift. I want to talk about Miri again.
Okay. Yep.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
I feel like I should just read a little bit about of what happens with Miri.
Okay. She shifts pretty abruptly, doesn't she, in terms of her tone? A full Miri comes out in this chapter.
Yeah. The mask comes off. "He lives," said Miri Mazdoor. "You asked for his life. You paid for life." Mm. "This is not life for one who was as Drogo was. His life was laughter and meat roasting over the fire pit and a horse between his legs. His life was an auric in his hand and bells ringing in his hair as he rode to meet an enemy. His life was his blood riders and me and the son I was to give him." Miri Mazdoor made no reply. "When will he be as he was?" Danny demanded. "When the sun rises in the west and sets in the east," said Miri Mazdoor. "When the seas go dry and the mountains blow in the wind like leaves, when your womb quickens again and you bear a living child, then he will return, and not before." Danny gestured at Ser Jorah and the others. "Leave us. I would speak with this Meggy alone." Mormont and the Dothraki withdrew. "You knew," Danny said when they were gone. She ached inside and out, but her fury gave her strength. "You knew what I was buying, and you knew the price, and you let me pay for it. It was wrong of them to burn my temple," the heavy, flat-nosed woman said placidly. That angered the great shepherd. "This was no God's work," Danny said coldly. "If I look back, I am lost. You cheated me. You murdered my child within me. The stallion who mounts the world will burn no cities now. His Khalasar will trample no nations to dust." "I spoke for you," she said, anguished. "I saved you." "Saved me?" the Lazarine woman spat. "Three riders had taken me, not like a man does a woman, but from behind as a dog takes a bitch. The fourth was in me when you rode past. How then did you save me? I saw my God's house burn, where I had healed good men beyond counting. My home they burned as well. In the street I saw piles of heads. I saw the head of a baker who made my bread. I saw the head of a boy who I'd saved from the Deadeye fever. Only 3 moons passed. I heard children crying as the riders drove them off with their whips. Tell me again what you saved." "Your life." Miri Mazdoor laughed cruelly. "Look at your cow and see what life is worth when all the rest is gone." And that... Mm-hmm. That's quite a movement. That is quite a movement.
It is. It reminds me of where she throws back to Danny, "You don't ask a slave, you tell a slave." Yeah,
right.
And so that part where Danny says, "This isn't life. This isn't anything like life." And then, of course, when Danny says, "But I saved you. What did you save?" "I saved your life." Mm-hmm. "Oh, this is life?" Mm-hmm. "You just said life has to be quality, right? Otherwise it's not life. I've had everything taken from me."
Yeah.
"I don't have life either." And I love how she turns that around and just kind of shows the hypocrisy, right, of Danny's statement in that moment. Uh-huh. "You just acknowledge that your call has no life. Well, I don't either. So you saved nothing."
And I think that what could be lost here, because, you know, we've read the whole story and we've watched the show and we know what happens with Dany and we know that she struggles with, you know, this sort of dual nature of Targaryens and all this. What I think could be lost here is that all of the sudden, for me at least, I'm seeing Dany in a new light. Mm. I'm seeing her not as the well-meaning, you know, silver savior or whatever. All of a sudden, I'm hearing Miri Mazdoor's voice, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, she's right.
She's right.
Why? Yeah. How could I ever have rooted for Danny's stallion who will mount the world? That would have been horrible. I could totally see from Miri Mazdoor's perspective how what she did, even though, call it murder, call it whatever you want, this was the right thing to do from her perspective.
Yes, she's absolutely right.
Which makes Danny the villain. It's like I feel like I've seen something revealed in this conversation that wasn't revealed before.
Do you think I've thought about this, because I think that at least in the show version, and admittedly it's been a while since I've watched it, but I mean, Miri is absolutely the villain, right? If you just even look at kind of the contrast between how they are presented, you know, even in the language of the book, Miri is heavy and stout and flat-nosed. Mm-hmm. She, you know, unattractive, darker skin. Then you've got Danny, the gold and silver, you know, beautiful, young, right? So they're very much contrasted. But in the
Miri
book version,
even has bad hair. Bad hair.
Right. There's nothing attractive about her. I wonder if you read the book carefully, I don't think that it's as stark in the book, right? Because how can you read those passages you just read and not come away with the understanding of, well, yeah. Right? I mean, not only you've got this woman who was not just a priestess, right? Not just a god's wife. She was highly trained, and she was not only trained by, you know, blood mages, but she trained with Marwyn.
Yeah.
Right? She was trained by a maester from the Citadel. So she had all of this knowledge and wisdom, right? She even acknowledges that, Maggie? I keep saying Magi. Means wisdom. Right. So you've got this woman who has spent her life gathering knowledge to do nothing more than help her people.
Well, she's a world traveler. She's a scholar. She's a healer. She's a priestess. I mean, she's all these things wrapped into one.
A light to her people. Right.
She's absolutely. You know, she is in this village healing people and making their culture work.
Right.
And
peaceful people. Peaceful, the lamb people.
Right. That's right.
They're not the conquerors here.
But all of a sudden, you know, these writers ride into town and she's a dog all of a sudden.
Yes.
And she's, you know, she's bright enough to see how the world really works. And she, whatever power she has at her disposal to make the world a better place, she thinks that's what I have to do. That's what I've devoted my life to do. And if I can kill this future tyrant, I'm going to do it.
Right.
And
she very much sets herself up as the protector of the flock.
That's right. And if you can get on board with that, even if you view her as a gray character, right? Even if you view her as, you know, she's not villainous, she's not heroic, she's like a lot of Martin's characters, she's complicated. But her complication reflects Danny's darkness and in such a way that has not happened before.
Yes. And I think that this is kind of like her Elena Terrell moment.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
She could have just said, oh, no, that was never my intention. I'm so sorry this happened. Mm-hmm. You know, she could have scaled back, but she just full force. You know, she doesn't deny it. She doesn't even try to deny it. When Danny says, you knew. Yep, I did.
Yeah.
I knew exactly. You know, you came in, these people burned my home, they killed my people. Of course, this is what I did. And in that moment, I think she is revealing how terrible, you know, Danny's actions were, how terrible the actions of the Khalasar were.
And yet, I think that you could also point out here that Danny was making choices, right? So she said, do it. You see, whatever magic you have, do it. And it was like, all right, I'm going to warn you about this.
Yes.
But
yes.
I'm going to give you what you want. And it was almost like, I don't care about you enough to not give you what you want. In fact, I kind of hope you ask for it because I think you kind of deserve it.
Yes.
But
yes.
But at the end of the day, she is a slave and she does what her master tells her to do. And what she knows that the master doesn't know is exactly what the consequence will look like. But she's just smarter than anyone else in this story so far. So,
and I don't think Danny still has accepted any responsibility here. Right. I mean, all throughout these passages, it's Dany saying, well, again, this is the price for the Iron Throne. It's for a larger goal. Mm-hmm. Or, no, I didn't want this. Mm-hmm. Right. Even though I heard pretty clearly from Drogo that this is what was going to happen. No, I didn't really understand. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, my baby died because Jorah took me into the tent.
Right. Yeah.
Or, you know, this happened because of this evil witch. She still isn't recognizing that actually you weren't just a witness. You were pretty culpable. Right?
Yeah, this
you
is what Dany thinks. She thinks
you participated in this, you know,
right.
that none of this, you know, was something that you just were kind of along for the ride for, right?
Yeah, this is a major show difference. Here we hear
it really is.
Dany say this. She says, Ser Jorah had killed her son, Dany knew. He had done what he did for love and loyalty, yet he had carried her into a place no living man should go and fed her baby to the darkness.
Yes.
He knew it
he
too.
He fed her baby. Yes.
Yeah, so she is totally like, you know, later on, Miri says, you didn't think it was the horse. That was the lie you told yourself.
Yes.
You knew the price. And Dany doesn't, like, protest. It's not like, at that point, she's like, did I know? You know, it's sort of, she's a little bit murky here.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to point out about Dany's shift here is that she finds out that this girl that she had saved prior and sort of taken as a slave was then raped several times and killed.
Yes.
And then she says, it was a cruel fate, Dany said, yet not so cruel as Mago's will be. I promise you that by the old gods and the new, by the lamb god and the horse god and every god that lives. I swear it by the mother of mountains and the womb of the world. Before I am done with them, Mago and Ko-Jago will plead for the mercy they showed Eroe.
Mm.
The Dothraki exchanged uncertain glances. Khaleesi, the handmaiden Eri, explained, as if to a child, Jako is a cow now, with 20,000 riders at his back. She lifted her head. I am Daenerys Stormborn, the blood of Aegon, the Conqueror, and Maegor the Cruel, and old Valyria before them. I am the dragon's daughter, and I swear to you that these men will die screaming. Now bring me to Khal Drogo.
Mm.
Okay.
So interesting, isn't it? How she describes herself. She's not Khaleesi there.
She's not
right?
Khaleesi. She says she rises. What does she say? She goes full Targaryen, she says.
Full Targaryen.
I am heir to the Iron Throne. I am the descendant of Maegor the Cruel, she names him, right? Why name Maegor the Cruel? Well, because for her to be full Targaryen is to be this creature of dragonish vengeance.
Yes.
She wants these men to die screaming.
Yes.
She wants to torture them to death. It's not like she's like a person of justice. She's a person of vengeance.
Vengeance.
And so when she goes full Targaryen, I think that in this chapter, she absolutely finds her voice. And it is scary.
It's scary. But you know what's interesting is no one quite believes her yet. Right. I mean, how many times does Jorah say, oh, you have a gentle heart?
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of spits back, I don't have a gentle heart. Mm-hmm. It sounds petulant
yeah,
in those earlier chapters.
Yeah,
this doesn't sound petulant, mm-hmm. right? And it reminds me again, if we flip back to the dream,
mm-hmm.
I think it's so interesting, not only just the change in language, right? Going from you don't want to wake the dragon, which is something her brother mm-hmm. constantly said to her. And it was a threat then. Right. That
yeah.
it kind of cowed her into obedience and doing what her brother wanted her to do.
Right.
And then we, you know, get progressively narrower. Right. We eliminate words
yeah.
from that
right.
sentence until we get to want to wake the dragon, the dragon.
Right.
And now this idea of waking the dragon is not something that is a threat to Dany. It's a threat from Dany. And it's all right here in this dream to the point where the visor is lifted and it's her.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer Rhaegar.
Yeah, Rhaegar's not the last dragon. She is.
He's not the last dragon. And so what I think is so interesting is she knows. This is my interpretation. I think she knows exactly what she's going to do when she wakes up. She hasn't maybe fully grasped that idea yet, but I think the plan is in motion, because when she wakes up, what is the first thing she does? She crawls toward the eggs.
Yeah, she wants the eggs. Like, she doesn't ask for Drogo. She doesn't ask for Rego, her son. Mm-hmm. She does ask for Jorah, but I think she asks for Jorah because she wants to order him to bring her the eggs.
Yeah,
she crawls for the eggs. She specifically asks for the eggs. And when she says, you know, when it goes, you know, you don't want to wake the dragon, do you? Until the language changes to just the dragon.
Yeah.
It's this transition from her brother's cruelty, right? The dragon always represented Viserys's cruelty. And then when she becomes the dragon, it's in a moment of cruelty. You know, it's yes. Like she's going to be cruel to these, you know, horrible, horrible men, right? But she's going to show them her cruelty in a way that her brother never could. It's, you know, her brother was always a shell of a Targaryen.
Right. And empty threats and empty promises.
To the core of her being, she is that person.
And I think you're right about this chapter being the apex, because she knows exactly who she is now. I think she knows what she's going to do. She knows the plan. She knows what her power will be, especially when those dragons hatch. But nobody else knows yet. And you can just see it, right? She's able to have that coldness and that vengefulness and that speech about, of course, I will wreak havoc on these men and I will take my revenge. Everybody's kind of like, oh, well, all right, whatever. And she knows that she's going to do it. It's now a matter of, I will show them. I know what it is, but that last chapter then is, here's the proof. And that's what makes that moment so great. She's already there. It's just a matter of showing everybody else that she's there. Mm-hmm. And that's when it happens.
I think that I want to sort of take a step back just for a moment and note that in this chapter, I absolutely see Dany as sort of the villain that she will eventually become. But I don't fully believe it yet. Like, I know with my head, not my heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not going to be too long before I'm rooting for her again. Right. I'm going to root for her against the slavers. I'm going to root for her against the wise men of Qarth.
Yeah.
I'm going to root for her against almost everyone who wants to do her harm. I'm going to root for her.
Yeah.
And it's one of these situations where I think that it'd be tempting to sort of like, oh, well, now we have our villain. But that's not the story that's not the kind of story that Martin likes to tell, right?
Right.
She's going to be the protagonist for another 5 books at least, right? So.
Right. I mean, you certainly see, I agree with you. You know, you read through this chapter especially and you think it was there from the beginning. You know, I don't think the show was as successful. I think the transition was maybe too abrupt, but it was there. You know, it was there all along. Just again, this idea of it's my heritage, it's my right, it's my blood. This is who I am. This is my destiny, right? I will, you know, destroy those who get in my way. And the crucial lesson she learns from Miri, I think, is how best to go about it, right? You don't win loyalty by re-enslaving people and saying they belong to you. How do you do it? You free them and say, okay, you have a choice, right? I will free you. You can go on your way. Or if you stay with me, I promise that I will protect you. And I've got these dragons now, right? Yeah. So she gets a lot wiser as she goes through and she learns how to earn loyalty.
That's true. And at this early stage, and she's still very young and.
Yes. And makes so many more mistakes, but this is her turning point where she goes from, you know, I kept writing in my notes. It's amazing how quickly she transitions from maiden mother crone. I mean, she just flies through those stages where she, you know, very young, naive, innocent, completely unfamiliar with how the world works. And then she goes through this mother stage where now I'm getting my power, not so much through, you know, my relatives, but through the child I will bear.
Yeah.
And then she becomes barren.
That's right.
And she transitions to the idea of the powerful crone who has sort of given this monstrous birth.
Yeah.
Right.
That's
which gives her power through her dragon. So I was thinking a lot about the mother maiden crone idea, you know, through various female characters and how they're feared, one, because they're powerful, but two, how they really kind of invert and pervert in many ways what women are supposed to be.
That's interesting. I'm so glad you point. I hadn't thought about that at all. It's sort of this, it's like she goes through this fast forward treatment. And the reason why that's so fascinating to me is because there's a little bit of a time discrepancy in this tent. So not only does she transition from, you know, maiden to crone seemingly overnight, although we're not sure how much time has actually passed. But when the baby's born, Miri says the baby has been dead for years. You know, it had death worms inside of it. And, you know, you get the idea that it's maggots and whatnot. So there's almost something weird with, like, the tent is a place of death where no man should enter. That's what she says. But, you know, people long dead are coming back to life, maybe. You know, the graves cast a long shadow is what Miri Mazdour said. And so the fetus has been dead for years. Well, how can that be? There's something weird happening, something distortative about time that's going on in this ritual.
Do you think, you just made me think of this, Anthony, do you think it's related to her mantra about if I look back, I am lost, but then she recognizes to go forward, she has to go back. And so there's that time element to that as well.
And then the red door,
which symbolizes the childhood.
Yeah.
So there are all kinds of distortions and juxtapositions with time, I think, especially in the Dani chapters.
Yeah, the dream is interesting because she's being chased by something cold that's that represents something like death that's behind her. And she's trying to pursue the red door, which I think represents her innocence or her childhood or something like that.
Right.
The house she grew up in had a red door. So she's racing for that. But all of a sudden, she becomes a dragon in her dream, right? And now she's flying over the sea, and she's looking at, you know, at Westeros with its stone houses and whatnot. So I'm not sure if I think she thinks that she's pursuing the past, but in reality, she's becoming something else. She's transforming into something else.
Right.
I'm not sure what's happening here. Because, you know, by the time the dream's over, I think she's got a pretty good idea about what has to happen with these eggs.
Yes.
So there's something in the dream that maybe wasn't revealed to us that kind of told her what to do with the eggs.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's in combination, if you think about that last chapter, there are all kinds of questions, too, about, you know, again, what exactly makes the eggs hatch?
Yeah.
And is she the mother of dragons? Is she the dragon? All kinds of questions about that, which is for another day. But I think there are lots of great hints in this chapter about what that means. And the fact that baby was born with dragon scales. And there's, you know, obviously the history of, you know, the Targaryen ancestral bloodline. So I think it all ties in. And maybe this idea of, again, innocence versus something dead and cold is very representative of the Targaryen line, as well as her own personal history. There's so much we could explore there.
One thing that is interesting to me is that when she's in the dream, I guess Jorah's voice is there. And Jorah basically says Rhaegar is the last dragon. And then she sees what she thinks is Rhaegar, you know, in full black armor, sitting atop a black horse. And she, you know, she pulls up the visor and it's her face on the inside. Suggesting that she's a stand-in for Rhaegar or some way, or Rhaegar is a stand-in for her in some way.
Do you think it's that she is now replacing Rhaegar because Rhaegar is dead? Or was it that Rhaegar was never meant to be the dragon, that she, in fact, is the dragon?
I think, yeah, I think that there, that is certainly there. I think it's important to note that in retrospect, what we know about Rhaegar is he's not a man of violence. He's not a man of cruelty. He's a man of poetry, and he's a man of generosity. And of course, you know, he falls in love with the wrong woman, and, you know, so he's got foibles, but he's not cruel.
Right. Yeah. In fact, when Khaleesi tries to save the women,
yeah,
Jorah even says to her, "You're like your brother."
Yeah.
Rhaegar, exactly. I mean, not the other one, not Viserys.
That's right. So it's almost like even in the dream here, she's like, okay, there's two paths. I could choose one. I could choose to be like my brother Rhaegar. But when she, you know, when she wakes up, she makes this proclamation that she's a descendant of Maegor the Cruel.
So. And Anthony, you made me think of this too.
Yeah.
In thinking about the two directions, one is the Red Door, one is, let's say, death, right?
Yeah.
You know, Jorah keeps saying, look, I'll take you back to Pentos. We'll escape. We'll sell your eggs. We'll, you know, lead this quiet, peaceful life.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of represented by that door. I could choose that path, right? I could just kind of go away and be happy and be rich and, you know, stay with Jorah and have comfort. And then do you think the other part of that is kind of foreshadowing what her eventual end will be, which is really death and destruction?
Interesting.
Once she makes that choice and moves forward and says, I'm the descendant of Maegor the Cruel, how she pretty much chosen that path, which will lead to that direction. I don't know.
Right.
Certainly that's what happens in the show version.
Yeah. I think that she doesn't want to leave. She doesn't like to leave scores unsettled.
Mm-hmm.
I think that like something's been promised to her. Her husband promised to her that they would go across the Salt Sea or the Poison Waters and take the Iron Throne. So now she's, you know, that's been promised. She's not going to give it up. She doesn't want to give up being his wife. She doesn't want to give up his life. She doesn't want to. Jorah's offering her a way out, but basically, in order to take his offer, she has to leave these scores unsettled. The same thing with these men who raped and killed the girl that she had saved, because they are out in the world riding free, not facing the consequences of her actions.
Right.
She cannot leave these scores unsettled. That's not in her nature, I don't think.
I think it's partly that, but don't you think it's also just, it's my birthright and I want power. And I don't think she fully acknowledges that to herself for a long time.
Mm.
Right? It's the idea that, oh, I keep saying I will save people and I'll free slaves and I'm going to do good in the world and all of these things. And I'm going to get vengeance for those who have wronged me, certainly. But I think part of this too is just, I deserve it. I'm the blood of the dragon. The usurper took away my family's destiny. It's my job to restore it.
That's a part of her. I mean, I think she is a creature of duality here, I think.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
That there
Which
is
makes
something...
her such an interesting character.
Yeah.
She's neither pure villain or pure hero. She's just an interesting combination of both.
Well, and also,
you're not sure which side is going to fully, you know, take over.
Right. I think that, I mean, this very literally, this is the chapter where she decides to wake the dragon.
Yes.
Right. And it suggests that she could choose not to do it, or that she's something else before the dragon wakes. She, you know, it was always sort of this facade that Viserys had, that he's actually a, you know, a kind older brother that has her best interests in mind. That was always a lie. He was always cruel. I don't get the sense that way with Dany. I think that, no, she actually does have this part of her that is interested in justice and interested in innocence and interested in, you know, the well-being of women and children.
Right.
That absolutely is a part of her, but she's going to wake that dragon, right?
So. Yes. Yes.
Anyway.
And again, I think she tells herself in doing that, it's a tool for all of those other more benevolent things that she wants to do.
Right.
And I think gradually that other part of her begins to take over.
Absolutely.
And the seeds are there, but it's that constant kind of struggle. And you see that in a lot of these characters, but I think especially in her.
Yeah. Jan, was there anything else that you wanted to talk about this chapter in particular?
Shall we talk about the mercy killing of Drogo? What do we think about poor Drogo? I mean, as a disability scholar, it pains me, right, to think that no one sees value in Drogo's life anymore.
Yeah.
It's the whole, you know, better dead than disabled horrible, you know, kind of assumption we have, I think, in society. Yeah. In the context of the book, of course, right? For her, Drogo was the call, right? He was the hunter, he was the rider, he was her sun and stars, right? Mm-hmm. And so for her, Drogo's no longer there. But there's kind of nobody around to say, well, he still enjoys the sun.
Yeah.
How do we know what's going on in his head? How do you know that he hasn't found some enjoyment in his new life? You know, nobody kind of steps up. I kind of wish someone would step up and say, actually.
It's true. Let me push back a little bit. I agree with everything you're saying. If Drogo could talk.
I want someone to speak for Drogo.
Yeah. If Drogo could talk, wouldn't he say, yeah, I don't want to go out. This is not the life I want.
Probably.
I mean,
knowing what we know about this culture, right?
Drogo.
Knowing
about, I mean, it's not like this is Tyrion we're talking about. It's Tyrion and Drogo are such different people. If this was Tyrion, he'd be like, you know what? Just let me enjoy the sun. I think I'm fine enjoying the sun. We don't have to end this. That's a little hasty, don't you think? I don't think that's how Drogo would view his life value, I suppose.
Probably not, but let me throw this in because it's just occurred to me. Do you think that Dany in this moment is killing Drogo for Drogo or for her? In the sense of she knows the choice she has made, right? She knows the path she's going to take.
Yeah.
Drogo doesn't fit into that path, right? Drogo really has no purpose in that path. If she were to go to Pentos, right, get some money, live out her days peacefully, there's a place for Drogo in that scenario. If she had chosen that other path, do you think she would have made a different decision with Drogo in that moment?
That's interesting. I think another way you could say that, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you could say that if Dany is going to become a dragon, she can't be weighted down by someone like Drogo.
That's probably, I mean, I don't want to ascribe too many kind of nefarious motives to Dany in this moment.
Sure.
She loved him, clearly.
Yeah.
She's devastated about what happened. I think she does see it. And I think it is, for her, more of a mercy, right? Yeah. I know that Drogo would not want to live this way. This is not this is not Drogo anymore.
Yeah.
This is not life. But just devil's advocate here, I wonder if there is a part of her that thinks, well, again, for me to be able to do what I need to do, there really isn't a place in this scenario for Drogo in this existence.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's pretty well said. I'm trying to think of a way to bring in the cultural discussion to this, because I think that different cultures have different ways of thinking about things like euthanasia.
Right.
I think that different cultures have different ways of creating space for disability. And I think that in many ways, sort of modern Western culture has failed in those ways. I think that the way that we treat our elderly is significantly diminished if you compare other cultures. So I'm curious about, like, maybe I'll like pose this to one of our medievalists to say, like, in a world where life expectancy is around 45 years old, do you revere the elders in such a way? And what is your approach to geriatric care in a society that doesn't really have all the medical means that we have today? Because I almost feel like some of these medical means are a little bit of a disservice to us at times.
Right. I mean, especially in the context of, you know, Game of Thrones. I mean, this is very historically contingent as well.
Yeah, right.
You know, I think there is a place for, you know, reverence of of elderly people in maybe Westeros and different parts, but in Dothraki culture, right? Manhood, life, quality, all of that depends on strength and vigor, right? Which, again, there's a great disability narrative to be spun about that, but that's the reality of life in Dothraki culture. And so I think for all of those who surround Drogo, he isn't really alive in that sense, because that particular culture attaches so much importance, particularly for men, on strength. Looking at Drogo, we might say, well, he's still strong in other ways from our modern perspective. But I think for them, strength is tied to, you know, physical strength and communication and all the things that Drogo used to do. Yeah,
we find out that all of the Khalasar is sort of dispersed, but that they've also taken all of their resources. So this is Rakaro. He says, they took Khal Drogo's herds, Khaleesi. We were too few to stop them. It is the right of the strong to take from the weak. They took as many slaves as well. So it's like, all right, well, if that's your life ethic, you know, if that's your worldview, that it is the right of the strong to take from the weak, that's just so foreign to my sensibilities that it's hard for me to even sort of project a sense of, like, what would be a good approach to disability in this culture? What would be a good approach to euthanasia in this culture?
Yeah.
It's just, it's so different. You know, this, and of course, this is an invention of Martin's, right?
Right.
But it's certainly one that Danny's not going to agree with.
And we know, and we know the larger attitudes toward disability, because we do have Tyrion, and we see how he has been stigmatized and discriminated against. And you know, Tyrion, probably my favorite character, Tyrion says how many times, thank goodness I'm rich. If I were not rich, I'd be dead. And I think that kind of just tells us right there, you know, how this particular society, how useless they consider, right, the disabled body and mind to be. So it's interesting, you know, to look at that as kind of a window into understanding, and then kind of comparing that to our own time and understanding that while things have dramatically changed, there is still tremendous stigma and misunderstanding about, you know, disability today.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, at the two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Notable introductions. Well, we're introduced to the sort of the monstrous description of Dany's child.
Yes.
We're introduced to the word dragon dew, which Dany calls this, calls the heat coming out off of the dragon that's causing her to sweat.
That's right.
And you could argue that we're introduced to Miri Mazdur's motives. I think that might be contentious to say, but let me just say this. We see a window into her thoughts in a way we haven't in previous chapters.
Right. Like we said, that mask fully comes off.
That's right. Notable departures. Well, a very notable departure. Drogo. Drogo departs.
And
such a big part of this first book. And in order for Dany to move on to the next stage of her narrative, he almost had to die.
Right.
And yet so important for her.
Is there a possibility in the books that Drogo could be resurrected if the prophecy is fulfilled? I know that's probably another subject for another day, but I have to admit, Anthony, I reread the last Daenerys chapter in A Dance with Dragons, which, you know, people have speculated she's pregnant in that chapter.
Oh, interesting.
And has a miscarriage. And I thought, oh, if she's pregnant, is that a hint on Martin's part that perhaps the prophecy is being fulfilled? I don't know.
Usually feel like I'm open-minded about these things. To me, until I hear otherwise, I read this statement by Miri Mazdur as a very pointed statement that it will never happen.
Yeah, very cruel, right?
Yeah. It said, what does she say here? Right after she says her little, like, what some people would call a prophecy, you know, the mountain blows away like leaves and whatnot. right after she says that, there's this interpretation by Dany, never, never, never. Right? She repeats it three times. It even says, then you will return, my sun and stars, and not before. Never, the darkness cried. Never, never, never. So as far as Dany's concerned, Drogo is gone. And I think for people who are kind of like pining for an outcome to this prophecy, I would almost ask, like, is that something that you think Dany wants? At this point, you know, at the end of book five, I don't think Dany wants Drogo to return.
She is so far removed from the person she was.
Oh, she's outgrown that person completely. So,
but it is interesting how Martin ends that book with all of this reminiscing. You know, it's a long chapter. If you read through it, which again, I did for the first time in a while last night, it's all about the past. It's all about Drogo and her baby.
Yeah.
And her looking back to her life with, you know, the Dothraki. And it's quite interesting how she has come so far from that. And yet it ends on the end. And I think probably part of that is a narrative device to remind the reader, remember when this happened, because what's the last scene there? Those old calls come riding up to her, the ones that she promised revenge on.
That's so right. I forgot about
that's
that.
Probably why, which is why I reread the chapter, Anthony, because I thought, does Martin end with her getting the revenge, or is that just in the show? And this so I went back and reread it and thought, oh, that's where it ends. That's our last. That's our last moment with Dany in the books.
Interesting.
Where she's standing next to Drogon, her dragon, and you see the Khalasar riding up.
Right.
And so, wow, what a moment to end on. So it's interesting. That's probably why Martin took us back.
Right.
But again, there's that passage where she feels sick. She starts to bleed and she says, oh, it must be my moon time. But then she looks up and says, no, it's not the moon time. I've never bled this heavily. So again, I think readers have speculated, interesting, that she's probably miscarrying at the same moment she's thinking about Drogo.
And she
even mentions Miri Mazdur in that chapter. So I don't know. I have no idea if that's going somewhere or... if I'm making too much of that, but that's what's fun about these books, trying to kind of figure out what it means and where it's going.
Well, what a rich and devastating and interesting chapter this was.
So interesting.
I feel like we could go on.
Easily.
I think there's a lot to be said about the placement of this in the book and, you know, how this sort of sets things up for, you could view this chapter as, okay, this isn't so much the climax of this book. It's the beginning of the next book.
Right.
You know, it's the beginning of a new story arc.
Right.
Okay. Well, I want to be conscious of our time.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me again. I'm always happy to revisit Game of Thrones and have these great discussions with you.
Thank you, Jim.